because the Bible is such an old book that its message is outdated, that it's become obsolete and has no relevance to the day in which we live. That's about half true. It is, of course, true that the Bible is an old book. The most recent words contained in this book were written 2,000 years ago. The words that, at least some of the words that are contained in the book of Proverbs, which is the focus of our study now, were written about 3,000 years ago. So it is an old book, but it is not obsolete. And in spite of the fact that people are always saying that it really doesn't have any relevance to us today, when it suits the convenience of somebody in this modern age, they'll quote from the book. For example, a quotation from the book of Proverbs was used in an argument before the Supreme Court of the United States recently. A case that had arisen in Chicago in 1995. There were 8 police officers and 4 patrol cars who had been dispatched to a crime-ridden section of Chicago to check on some drug sales. And 2 of the officers in the 4th car happened to see a fellow by the name of Sam Wardlow standing in front of 4035 West Van Buren Street. And when Sam saw them, he took off running. And the officers, of course, suspected that he had some reason to flee from them, and so they pursued him. They caught him. They put him under arrest after they patted him down and found that he had a Colt 38 caliber revolver with 5 rounds of ammunition in it. So they took him to trial. When he came before the trial judge, his attorney argued that the search was unconstitutional because the officers had no reason to suspect that Sam had committed a crime, and therefore the fruit of their search was illegal, couldn't be used in trial. The judge ruled to the contrary. He said, yes, in a crime-ridden area like this area in Chicago, when a man runs and there doesn't seem to be any reason for him to run from the police, they could automatically suspect that he has something to hide. So the court allowed the evidence. Sam was convicted and sentenced to 2 years in jail. Well, as you can imagine, his attorneys appealed, first to the appellate court of the state of Illinois. The appellate court sided with Sam and said the search was unconstitutional and the sentence would have to be set aside. The appeal then went to the Supreme Court of Illinois. And again, the court ruled that the search was unconstitutional and that the conviction would have to be set aside. The attorneys for the state of Illinois, the attorney general, and also one of the attorneys that tried the case in Chicago, then appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And when they were there appealing and arguing that case just recently, one of the things that they cited was a passage from the book of Proverbs. These attorneys argued that an unprovoked flight from police officers is indication of culpability. And they said that principle can be traced all the way back to the book of Proverbs. And they quoted Proverbs 28 and verse 1. The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the innocent are as strong as a lion. Well, I don't know how that's going to turn out. I don't know if the Supreme Court will buy that argument or not. But it does seem strange to me that the same people who will tell you that the Bible is obsolete always find it convenient to use quotations like this when it seems to fit the situation for them. So, for the next few moments, let's focus our attention on the book of Proverbs. Unfortunately, I used a wrong color for those headings. You won't be able to see that, but you have every one of these slides in the handout there before you. You shouldn't have any difficulty in keeping up. We're talking about modern wisdom from ancient writings. And the first thing we need to do is to address the issue of authorship. I'm sure that all of us have done what L.G. talked about with regard to the book of Psalms. We've always just said that David said, and all 150 Psalms, we take it for granted that David wrote them, which is not true. And the same thing can be said about the book of Proverbs. We have, many of us, just automatically assumed that all of these Proverbs were written or spoken by Solomon, that doesn't seem to be true either. As I've indicated on this slide, the book begins by saying that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel, chapter 1, verse 1. And that's true probably for the next 9 chapters. Then in chapter 10 at verse 1, again, we have another introduction, the Proverbs of Solomon. Now, there's a distinct difference between those first 9 chapters and the chapters that begin with chapter 10. In the earlier chapters, there are themes that are developed usually for several verses. When you get to chapter 10 at verse 1, from now on you're going to see a bunch of two-liners. For the most part, the proverbs that take up the next several chapters are just two-line proverbs, and as was indicated by Smith earlier, they follow that Hebrew literary strategy of using parallelism. I thought for a while that Smith was going to say enough about parallelism that I could just say amen and go on, but I am going to talk a little bit about that literary device as well. But now, when you get over to chapter 22 at verse 17, there's an indication that there may be some different authors here. We can't know that with certainty because all that these verses tell us is, hear the words of the wise. Now, since Solomon was noted for his wisdom, it's entirely possible that that's still a reference to Solomon, but we can't say that with certainty. It may, in fact, be the case that there were some other wise men in Israel. And, you know, that wouldn't really surprise us because there were wise men in all of the nations at that particular time period. We read about wise men everywhere, those wise men that came from the East at the birth of Jesus. So every nation had wise men. And we cannot know with certainty that Solomon is referred to in this verse. Down toward the end of this section, at chapter 24, verse 23, you find a similar statement. These are the words of the wise. Now, after you get to the end of chapter 24, then you have an indication of a different authorship. Here at the beginning of chapter 25 in verse 1, we're told that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, still the same author actually, but there is a significant difference. These are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. As I indicated on that previous slide, Solomon lived in the 900s B.C., and these men lived 200 years later. They were living during the reign of Hezekiah, one of the good kings in Judah. And this passage says that they gathered up some of these proverbs. We learn from the fourth chapter of 1 Kings that Solomon wrote about 4,000 or 3,000 different proverbs. So it wouldn't be surprising if there were all kinds of proverbs out there that the people knew about that had been handed down verbally, orally, and then all of a sudden it decided came to somebody's attention that we ought to preserve these things. And so they compiled them and put them in writing. Then there are a couple of other interesting characters over at the end of this book. In chapter 30 at verse 1, we're told that these are the words of Agur, son of Jecha of Massa. And chapter 31 that contains that famous passage about the virtuous woman. We sometimes say that Solomon wrote that too. But again, it's highly questionable that Solomon actually wrote that because the words are really attributed to somebody by the name of Lemuel, and we're told that these are the words of Lemuel, king of Massa, which his mother taught him. Now, the Hebrews have always said that those were kind of pseudonyms, that they were in fact other names by which Solomon was known. And so Hebrew scholars even now will say that these were just two different words, Agur and Lemuel, actually refer to Solomon. In the pulpit commentary, the authors had this to say. Jewish interpreters have explained the name symbolically of Solomon himself. Agur may mean gatherer, convener, from agar to collect, and is applied to the wise king either as a master of assemblies, Ecclesiastes 12:11, our collector of wisdom and maxims elsewhere called Kohelet, Ecclesiastes 1, verse 1, though this interpretation of the latter word is very questionable. Jacob is rendered obedient or pious, so the gatherer, son of the obedient, would designate Solomon, son of David. Now that sounds pretty ingenious to me. And I think they're really grasping for straws. I think they came up with a preconceived notion that Solomon had to write these words, and now they're trying to figure out some way to justify that belief. They do exactly the same thing with the word lemuel. Lemuel means unto God. It's equivalent to dedicated to God. And it's supposed to be applied to Solomon, who from infancy was dedicated to God and called by him Jedediah, beloved of the Lord, 2 Samuel 12 and verse 25. There is, of course, another possibility that the word Massa refers to a location. And according to the authors of the pulpit commentary, that location would be up in Arabia. And it may very well be that these two individuals came from that area. There is a belief that there was a queen mother there, very much like the Queen of Sheba, that she may in fact have visited with Solomon at some time, and that these two men, Agur and Lemuel, were in fact her sons, and that they may in fact have learned from her the proverbs that are attributed to them here in the book. Well, as I say, that explanation really sounds more ingenious to me than it does like really trying to interpret what the Bible actually says. The mere fact that these words found their way into the sacred canon is good enough evidence for me that regardless of who the human penman happened to be, that God was placing his stamp of approval upon this message as being meaningful and valuable to mankind. Now, it's important for us to know something about the meaning of the terms that we're discussing here. I think it's important for us to fully realize that there is a difference between the Proverbs, these works which have already been described as being poetry, as opposed to some of the other things that are found in the Bible. I think we'll save ourselves a lot of embarrassment and a lot of false interpretation if we understand that there is a difference between a proverb, for example, and a promise. And nowhere is that more evident than when you get down to chapter 22 and verse 6. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. I think a lot of parents have unnecessarily flagellated themselves, browbeat themselves, punished themselves by feeling the mere fact that my children went astray is proof positive that I was a bad parent. This is a proverb. It's not a promise. And there's a difference between a promise and a proverb. We'll come back to that in just a moment. But look at this. The term proverb is defined by Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary as being a Greek popular epigram or maxim, an adage. Now, I think that when you look at that word as it's used in the Bible, that it takes on a little bit different meaning. The authors of the pulpit commentary, for example, say that this word is derived from a root meaning to be like. It's a word of comparison, and therefore has primarily the meaning of comparison or similitude. Several authors, in fact, have considered that the word parable is a synonym. And I believe Smith mentioned, and if he didn't, I will, that there is one category of parallelism that has to do with the parabolic parallelism. So what are some of the kinds of proverbs that we find here in this book? The authors of the pulpit commentary identify about five different kinds. There's one kind that I didn't put up here because they don't cite an instance of it in the book of Proverbs. It's a historical kind of proverb. And they cite 1 Samuel 10, verse 12, as being an illustration of that type of parable. In that passage it says, is Saul also among the prophets? And they contend that that is an example of a historical proverb. But as I said, they did not find an illustration of this type of proverb in the book of Proverbs, so I just simply focused on the four kinds of proverbs that they think they do find in this passage. For example, there's the metaphorical proverb. Illustrations of that would be chapter 1 and verse 17. In vain is the net spread in the eye of any bird. Their view is that a metaphorical proverb enunciates some moral truth under a figure drawn from nature or life. So here the wise man has looked at a creature of nature, and he says that if you're going to set a net for a bird, you better be sure the bird doesn't see what you're doing, because the bird isn't going to fall for that trap. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Chapter 6 and verse 6 is another illustration of this. Or chapter 17 and verse 12. Let a bear robbed of her whelps meet a man rather than a fool his folly. We all, of course, know that if you take away the bear cubs from the mother bear, she's going to be quite angry and probably is going to do all the damage she can to you. And here the wise man is saying that when a fool meets his folly, he's just as silly as that bear. He loses all ability to reason. He can do all kinds of damage. Then there is, as I've indicated here, the enigmas. This is another category of proverbs. And the authors of the pulpit commentary say that these are obscure questions which need thought to elucidate them, like the words of Agur there in chapter 30 and verse 4. Who hath ascended up into heaven or descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fist? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell? Now, a passage like that will cause you to do a lot of deep thinking, and it'll take you a long time to try to figure out exactly what the answer to those questions might be. In fact, you may never come up with the answer, but that's why it's an enigma. It's a puzzling thing. And it does require extra effort in order to understand it. The third category found in this book would be called parabolic. And that presents truth and things in allegorical shape, like chapter 9 and verse 1 that says that wisdom hath builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. Here wisdom is personified, represented as a woman that is building a house. Hewed out the seven pillars probably refers to the foundation that's being prepared for the superstructure. It's not going to be a superstructure that's built on the sand, but rather on a solid foundation. And then didactical is the fourth category of proverbs that give precise instruction on points of morals, religion, or behavior. For example, chapter 8 and verse 33, hear instruction and be wise and refuse it not. Now, there isn't anything difficult about understanding that. It's just a straightforward admonition as to the kind of behavior that is becoming of those of us who are studying this book. And I think chapter 22 and verse 6 falls in that same category. Train up a child in the way that he should go. That's just as straightforward as it can possibly be. Well, as you study the book of Proverbs, you're going to discover that Solomon had a very specific agenda. There was a very specific purpose, and you don't have to read far to find out what that is, because it's found there in the opening verses of this book. He tells us that the purpose of this book is to provide or make it possible for us to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment and equity. He gives subtlety to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear, Solomon says, and will increase learning. And a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels to understand the proverb and the interpretation, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. There are a lot of synonymous terms used in that passage, but the bottom line is that this book was intended to make it possible for us to receive wisdom. And that's really what the emphasis is here. It's not so much on the fact that Solomon is writing things that will convey wisdom. The emphasis is on the fact that if you're a wise person, you'll receive this instruction. That's where the rub comes in. It doesn't make any difference how wise Solomon is or how wise his sayings are. If we don't imbibe deeply of that information, if we don't accept it into our makeup, and if we don't receive it as instruction, it is valueless so far as we are concerned. Now, that passage tells us that much of what's found in this book is going to be a contrast between those who are wise and those who are foolish. Notice some of the qualities, some of the characteristics that are set forth here about those people who are wise. Chapter 10, verse 19, for example, says, "In the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin." Just think about that for a moment. Those of us who tend to rattle all the time, just talk all the time, think about that. The more words you speak, the more likely it is that there will be something sinful that will slip out of your lips. But in contrast with that, he says, "He that refraineth his lips is wise." We have another proverb, you know, that says that silence is golden. There's an element of truth in that. The inspired writer in the New Testament tells us to be swift to hear, slow to speak. Chapter 11, verse 30 tells us that the wise man is the person who will win souls. Chapter 12, verse 15 tells us that a fool is right in his own eyes. Fool never thinks that he's wrong about anything. He just thinks he's right about everything. But Solomon says, "He that hearkeneth unto counsel is the wise one." The person who's teachable, who knows that he doesn't know everything and that there's much he can learn. Chapter 19, verse 20 says, "Hear counsel and receive instruction, that thou mayest be wise in the latter end." So, all of these passages tell us about what the qualities of a wise man would be. We can, in fact, if we're wise, learn from what happens to other people. As chapter 21, verse 11 tells us, "The scorner is punished, the simple is made wise." Incidentally, the word simple there doesn't mean a simpleton. It doesn't mean a dope. It doesn't mean somebody who's a dummy. It's referring to somebody who's teachable. And that word is often used in contrast with fools in this book, because we need to be teachable. We need to be receptive to information. No wonder Solomon said in chapter 4 and verse 7, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding." In fact, the acquisition of wisdom is viewed as sort of a commercial project or undertaking here. The word that's translated "get" in that passage really refers to a commercial transaction. And it's in perfect keeping with chapter 23 and verse 23, where Solomon said, "Buy the truth and sell it not." Well, these verses that we just looked at tell us a little bit about the qualities of the fools, but there are some other verses that tell us what you can expect in a foolish person. First of all, Solomon says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." Chapter 12, verse 15, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes." Chapter 14, verse 9, "Fools make a mock at sin." When you hear somebody who is just constantly saying that sin isn't such a big deal, you can mark it down. That person is a fool in the Bible sense of the term. People who don't think that sin is a very big deal and who think that Christians are silly for making such an issue out of sin, the Bible says they are fools. Chapter 26 and verse 11 says that as a dog returneth to his own vomit, so a fool returneth to his own folly. You get a guy out of trouble, and if he's a fool, he'll go right back into it. And he'll repeat that process over and over again. Even if his trouble is as disgusting as a dog's vomit, just like a dog goes back to that disgusting deposit, so a fool goes back to his disgusting behavior. Well, as Smith indicated in the lesson a while ago, these proverbs are largely based upon the literary device known as parallelism. And the authors of the Book of Commentary, and I've quoted quite a bit from them on these issues, although I've done a lot of research and other authors too, and it'll be found in the bibliography for this article when it appears in print. These people say that proverbs features a literary device known as parallelism, the balancing of thought against thought, corresponding in form and sound, often in sound, so that one line is an echo of another. The second member is either equivalent to the first, or contrasted with it, or similar to it in construction. Now, let me just hurriedly give you some illustrations of the types of parallelism that are found in this book. One type is synonymous parallelism, which has been defined as the second hemistich, which really means the second line, merely repeats the first with some little alteration of words in order to enforce the truth presented in the former. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his own spirit than he that taketh the city. Both those lines mean essentially the same thing. And although I may risk stirring up a hornet's nest, my conviction is that Jesus used that strategy in Matthew 6 and verse 10 when he said, "Pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." It's not original with me. I got it from William Barclay. But I'm convinced that that is parallelism. That Jesus defines what the kingdom is in that passage by saying that God's kingdom is any place that God's will is being done on earth as it is in heaven. That's why I still feel that I can legitimately pray that prayer. I know the kingdom came to Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, but I also know that there are a lot of places on the face of the earth today where the kingdom still has not come, because the will of God is still not being done. So it's legitimate to pray, "Thy kingdom come," if we have that understanding that the kingdom of God is wherever the will of God is being done. Another type of parallelism is antithetical. And it presents the second member and the second member a contrast to the first, bringing forward a fact or an idea which offers the other side of the picture. So this passage: "The labor of the righteous tendeth to life, the increase of the wicked to sin." You get both sides of the picture. This tells us what will happen when a righteous man labors and works, and it tells us what will be the outcome of any effort put forth by the wicked. There is synthetical parallelism, and this is the kind where two different truths are connected by some feature common to both of them. An illustration of that would be chapter 10, verse 24. "The fear of the wicked, it shall come upon him, and the desire of the righteous shall be granted." So here's a passage that, in both of these instances, the focus is on the future. What does the future have in store for the wicked? Well, his fear is going to come upon him. What does the future have in store for the righteous? His desire. The desire of his heart. What he longs for is going to become available to him. Then there's the integral proverb, where the second line completes the thought which is only begun in the first. "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch upon the evil and the good." It helps us to appreciate what God's eyes are really looking at. This verse says that they're in every place and they're seeing the evil and the good. We used to sing that song, "It's all-seeing eye watching you." And we ought to revive that song, because people may have forgotten that he is in fact watching. The parabolic proverb is one which is perhaps the most striking and significant of all. It's capable of manifold expression. Herein a fact of nature or in common life is stated, and an ethical lesson is drawn or grounded upon it. Like the passage to which allusion was made earlier, "As vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so the sluggard to them that send him." So is the sluggard to them that send him forth. It's a parable. It's a lesson that's drawn from the facts of life. Now, there is another kind of parable that we find, or another kind of proverb that we find here in the book of Proverbs, and it's a numerical proverb where a number is stated, and then that number is usually increased by one. Like in chapter 6 and verse 16, there be six things which the Lord hated. And then notice that he raises it to one. Yea, seven, which are an abomination unto him. So if I counted my time properly, I think I've run out of time. And so I'll stop right here.